My name is Paul Menzel. This continues the series on healthcare policy questions. The topic for today is, I've titled Medicaid or Cash for the Poor, the Politics of Paternalism. I want to discuss the form that healthcare aid for the poor should take. And I throw the word politics in a rather unusual sense of the justifications for a political policy, not the actual operating legislative politics, though the fact that I will argue that I think the most solid remaining ground after you clear out the other arguments for a policy like Medicaid is paternalistic should say something about the whole political orientation of our society toward the poor. But I'm getting a little out on a limb on that one. I am today going to go way out on the limb on a number of things. Please realize that I'm bracketing some of this in my own mind. I'm much less sure of my arguments here than I am on anything else I'm going to say during the week. But I'm driven to what I'm going to say just by some arguments, not at all by my initial intuitions. My initial intuitions are quite the opposite to most of what I'm going to say. And yet I think the arguments that I've been able to see lead me in a somewhat different direction, which ultimately isn't at odds with my political and ethical loyalties, but which at first seems a little surprising. First thing I'm going to argue today, before we get into the concrete matter of what policy we should have in providing aid, healthcare aid for the poor, is that I'm going to argue that we should not assume that people have a right to equal health care. We usually think, we often think, that justice requires that we say that people have a right to equal health care. And the basic intuition behind this is that health is the most important thing you can have in life to start all your other projects. And that therefore, if the state is going to provide education, if it's going to protect rights to free speech, which is sort of the foundation of a lot of other roles we play in public life and in our own private welfare too, that heaven forbid we should certainly first of all say that people have a right to equal health care, even before we would say they have a right to equal education, equal elementary and secondary education. Well, I have been led to reject the notion of a right to equal health care simply by looking carefully at the value that people in different circumstances put on health care. It's a direct outgrowth of the price of life discussions in the previous days. Simply put, or reviewing some things, if the monetary price of life, or if the monetary price of some measure that reduces the risk of death, the risk of a threat to life, is gauged by people's willingness to spend resources on that, reducing the risk to life, instead of on other things, then it becomes very clear that poor people who have fewer resources to work with, i.e., they have greater competing non-healthcare needs than we do, are going to choose to spend less on a healthcare system. Now, they will want an appendectomy when appendicitis is threatening their very life, just as you and I will. But if they had their druthers in starting out and shaping a whole a healthcare delivery system for them, they would not devise one which involved anything like the sophisticated and expensive care that we have in our society. Now, one of the ways you can see this is by looking at what poorer countries do. Assuming they're not just foolish, do they have the same kind of hospitals, etc., that we do? No. Most of them, again, to go back to an issue yesterday, will emphasize preventive care simply because it gives you more benefits for the dollar. Many preventive care programs do. And they will not have much emergency crisis care at all. And it seems to me that that's a very shrewd decision of a poorer country. To take an extreme case, in Morocco, a water sanitation project will save lives at the cost of 140 dirhams a day. That's their unit of currency. A hospital will save lives to the tune of 11,000 dirhams a day. Now, which would you do? Well, you might say, but we are Western developed society and all the poor people here should regard the lives of all poor people here as monetarily having the same price as any other life in the society. And so a poor person's life shouldn't be thought to have a monetary valuation any different than any other person's life. But again, I come back to the question of competing needs for resources. And I think you can see the point there, that a poor person does not just foolishly choose to spend less on health care than a middle class person. A poor person quite wisely chooses to spend less on health care than a middle class person. Now, if that is the case, then though there still might be something very compelling about the notion of a right to health care, it's no longer a right to equal health care. And what we'll be trying to uncover in some of this is the very murky problem, which I still have great difficulty sorting out, what the scope of the term the right to health care should be, which is still something short of a right to equal health care. There's a right to a certain basic, cost-worthy health care, cost-worthy for even the poor, that I think we could justify. But how do we defend that? To take a particular line that one economist has used, isn't it, an economist at Harvard, Thomas Schelling, says, isn't it simply medical imperialism or particular defensiveness of the middle class that leads us to fund a program? He's being a little imaginative here. He's not saying it's actually fun. To fund a program which would provide Novocaine for dental patients, a poor dental patient, to the tune of $30 a shot, Novocaine, when the person would rather have the $30 and put up with the pain. Sure, it's nicer for the dentist to give the Novocaine shot. Sure, it's nicer for the rest of the society to know that when it's giving health care aid to the poor, that poor person is not going to be sitting in a dentist chair enduring pain, which all of us have come to think we needn't endure, and $30 is easily worth, or whatever it costs for Novocaine shot is easily worth it. But the example is used to make a point, not that it's literally, not that the $30 figure is correct, or that Novocaine shots are actually funded by the government, but I think the point comes through. What does impel us to cover a measure like that if we covered it? It would be the guilt feelings of the middle class and the interests of the healthcare providers, the dentists. That's what would lead us to fund something like that. Now then, you just take that thought and ask the same question about other things in the healthcare system. Now, of course, it's much more complex than just saying that everything is in modern medicine is like the Novocaine. We don't want to say that poor people wouldn't find a lot, would find very little in modern medicine that was a good buy. There still might be a lot. And as I said, the real problem here is trying to draw the line. But the first conclusion I come to is that we should reject the notion of a right to equal health care. And that rejection stems from respect for the poor and their competing other needs. That's precisely what it stems from. It does not stem from a reticence to acknowledge their ideal legitimate claims of justice on the rest of the community. Now, when we get to the question of what form healthcare aid should take, I think there are four basic forms it can take. In the United States, we have currently the second. The first form it can take is that the government can actually provide the care. An example of that would be the British National Health Service, which provides the care. It provides it for everybody, not just for the poor. But you could also have direct government provision for the poor. Government insurance is a second form. The government doesn't provide the care, it just pays the bill. It's an insurer just like any other insurer, and it pays somebody else to provide the care. Like any insurer, it has to have regulations about what is covered, what percentage of what is covered, who are legitimate providers, etc. So currently, you probably wouldn't get covered if you went to certain healthcare providers who were sort of on the controversial margin of healthcare. You would, if you really did need massage therapy from a good massage therapist for some health problem, it might be the best therapy. You wouldn't get covered under Medicaid. A third form, so the government sets, you know, what's covered. In the first form, the government actually provides it, so you don't even have a choice. People, in a sense, do not have a choice of whom to get it from. I'm not at all implying that it's worse care because of that lack of choice. Vouchers are a third arrangement, which are presently being, I think, going to be pushed by the Reagan administration. A voucher system, unlike government insurance, is not a matter of the government paying the bill after the healthcare expenses are incurred. It's not that at all. It's a matter of the government paying part of the bill before the expenses are incurred. That is, the government would give to a person who's eligible to get a voucher, there would be income requirements for that, a certificate, a voucher, which that person could use to say it's worth $60 a month. That family, poor family, can take that $60 a month voucher and use it toward any health care plan it chooses. It's the health care plan it chooses, the family chooses, that is then the payer, the insurer, or in the case of a prepaid plan or health maintenance organization, the direct provider. The government is not doing the insuring. The government is simply giving people the money with which to get an insurance plan of some sort. But it has to be for a health insurance plan. It's still restricted to health care. It can't be used for anything else. The fourth form radically departs from these three. These three all tie the aid to health care, though with different levels of choice as to how what that money's going to be, how it's going to be used. Cash doesn't tie it to health care at all. By cash, I mean income maintenance, where we would not have, if you want to extend it beyond the health care area, we would not have food stamps, not have rent subsidies, not have Medicaid, not even have vouchers. We would have income maintenance through a negative income tax or whatever other arrangement you have. And then people would choose whether they wanted this kind of insurance policy, no insurance policy, etc.
Would the voucher be for insurance, or would it be for the service too? Would there be an option to use it either
no.
way?
The voucher has to.
It could be
either way, except $60 a month doesn't go very far, or even $100 a month doesn't cover anything if you hit a crisis. So the usual form it's suggested in is to be used only for some kind of insurance. Now that might include, that of course includes what economists don't technically call insurance, but instead call prepaid plans, where you pay the provider instead of paying an insurer ahead of time. Instead of paying an insurer ahead of time, you pay the provider ahead of time. You actually pay an entity that employs the healthcare professionals ahead of time. But yes, you would have to.
Like
the usual form is
Seattle.
Yes. Right. You would use the usual form of that the voucher proposal takes is that the vouchers are good only for insurance or prepaid plans. Yes.
I really see problem there with the cash because it would be used not for health care, and then eventually the person would still become a responsibility
okay.
of the state.
That's the whole issue.
Oh,
that's
I'm
the
sorry.
Whole problem. Yes, that precisely is the problem. About cash.
Is the voucher thing to put the screws on the screw on the vendor to drive the prices down as you go shopping?
Oh, yes. The voucher proposal is being pushed precisely by the people who, in relation to other policies about healthcare, are pushing competition.
And that would limit the amount of care that you might be able to get and would really drive many people to the bad wackos and give you a low rate and also bad service.
It depends how big the voucher is. The main person who has gotten a big name for pushing proposals to increase competition in healthcare by, for example, requiring every employer to make available at least 3 plans to all employees. And the 3 plans must cover a variety, must be of different sorts, too. And you'd have regulations about what different sorts they have to cover. There can be 6 plans, too, but it has to be at least 3. Mm-hmm. And the employer could not pay more for one than for the other. So that any difference that is paying, getting the more expensive plan, would have to come out of the employee's pocket.
Who makes the rule that the
government.
The government can tell an employer that you must provide 3 plans or have 3 plans available. Some companies don't have any plan.
The government would say that if you're going to provide a plan, you have to provide a choice of at least 3 plans.
The company, the way I hear that, the company can set aside so much money, and the person has an option of picking up a plan.
Yes.
The company's only going to pay, let's say, $50 a month, and if the employee wants plan A that costs $200 a month,
that's right. It's not that the employer has to provide the whole bill, pay the whole bill. It's whatever bill the employer provides, the employer has to give employees a choice of 3 plans to apply that toward. And the employer is not allowed to pay more for one of those plans than for the other 2. Okay. That's going to create competition because it's going to make people think about the cost, the premium, before they sign up for a plan.
Some companies have self-insured type plans. Are they required to do this too?
Yes, they would be required to pay the equivalent amounts in credit toward another plan. But if in fact, the only reason for self-insuring would be that their plan is cheaper, so they'd be able to beat out the competition.
What about unions that have good medical plans?
Again, they would be required to offer 3 options to their members.
Well, then you have competition between three insurance companies.
That's right. That's right.
With each individual arguing, I'll give you a better cut. So I won't get so much commission. I'll give you part of my commission if you take my plan. That's what you're insinuating.
Well, it's not a matter of giving kickbacks.
And you take any big union, that's half of the battle right there. Who's going to get the biggest kickback?
Well, that would have to be regulated out, too.
Well, yeah.
The reason that the main scholar here, some of you are interested in reading things, and he has a book called Health Plan, which is just the defense of the whole competition-creating approach to medical costs, including an explanation of how the voucher system would work. Antoven's been very, very good about emphasizing that, unlike some other people who are pushing competition, his is not a proposal, and he has no interest in proposals which slight the poor. And he wants to include, that is, what he calls the vouchers in the whole business of creating competition. You must give poor people a sizable voucher, enough to cover a respectable health care or prepaid or insurance plan. The size of that voucher would vary with income. For the very poor, it would cover the entire bill for the cheapest plan in the area. And for the though you could use it to get more expensive plans if you wanted. That's what the amount would be. And then it would decrease with income. It'd be a sliding voucher. But it's still tied to health care. Now, if in fact the voucher is fairly small, then what you're really allowing poor people to do is shift is make choices about where they're going to spend their resources, because the voucher is small. It's about the minimum that anybody would ever want to use anyhow. The problem is that when it gets small, you aren't giving them, if it gets really small enough so that poor people are creating enough of their own market so that they're forcing into existence through their demand, enticing into existence, low-style, low-cost plans, which may frankly have care which is obviously less sophisticated and less lower in quality than the rest of the society, then if you're going to give them that much freedom to create that market, then the voucher is probably so low that for many of them, given that they're going to want to spend a little more on health care, they're pinched and they can't find the resources to spend it. So they then move to cash. Wouldn't it be better to have a good income maintenance system instead of both Medicaid or any of the in-kind provisions? In-kind just means tied to health care. And also instead of food stamps, rent subsidy, etc. Then it is a combination of poor people. It is poor people acting in the marketplace that will shape the providers and the institutions the providers work in. Now, ideally, of course, that looks very nice. The question is, can we overcome some very strong practical objections like, what if a person, poor person, doesn't buy the insurance, left out on a limb, won't we have to rescue that person in a time of crisis anyhow? Isn't that unfair on the society? Because you've got some free riders there among the recipients of the income maintenance. Well, those are some of the arguments. Let me just note, behind this discussion, what I should have noted in my argument that we should reject the notion of a right to equal health care. It relates to the... No, let me back up a minute. I forgot to explain. The easiest way to justify income is to say, well, if you give people the freedom to choose a very low-style health care plan, or no health care or health insurance plan at all, they're going to abuse it. And that will be to their own detriment. So we, the society, are going to restrict their choice. The aid we will give them will be in the form of a voucher, insurance, or direct provision, so that they don't make foolish decisions to try to get along without health care insurance. That argument, I'm not rejecting it. I'm simply noting that it's a paternalistic argument. And by paternalism, I mean restricting another person's freedom for that other person's own good. Not because that person, by their behavior, is affecting others, which may give others a more legitimate role in restricting their choices, but restriction is placed on the people because it's necessary for their own good. That's paternalism. I think it's transparent in the term why it's paternalism, because parents do that all the time for children and have to. We haven't gotten out of the paternalism into something that's neutral between maternalism and paternalism on that. If anybody comes up with a term that's sex neutral, that I would very much appreciate knowing what it is. Ternalism. Okay, good. Or aternalism. Just leave out the P or the F.
How about neuternalism?
Neuternalism?
Or parentalism.
Parentalism. Parentalism would be. Does it have the same connotations in general? It probably does, doesn't it? Parentalism. That's right. That should be the term we should adopt. Okay. Non-parentalistic. What I would like to find, if I could, is a non-parentalistic argument for in-kind aid. I would like to restrict aid, too. I see tremendous dangers in the cash approved. I mean, you just pointed them out. But I want to know what arguments there are for in-kind provision. And I don't want to resort to a parentalistic argument, because we have rejected that argument. Number one, we've rejected that argument in other areas of healthcare policy. I also have a distaste for the argument in general when applied to adults.
Dave, well, go ahead. You've already mentioned one, didn't you? And that is that if crisis care becomes a problem, then that is a societal problem, not simply an individual.
I'll get to that.
Good problem. Okay. I'm wondering if there's another one, namely that individuals represent not only a detriment to a society, they also represent a contribution. So that if you want to maintain maximal health for individuals in a society so that they can contribute to goods and services and so on and so forth.
So the society has an interest in getting people to use that aid and
yes.
for health insurance.
Yes, right, right. For the good of society, not just for the good of an individual.
Okay. That would be a non-parentalistic,
right.
non-paternalistic
right.
argument. Except that, okay, that gets us to the question of the reason for, let's just take that argument up right now. That gets us to the question, why are we providing aid and assistance to the poor at all? I would keep them from revolting. Okay, if that's what it is, then let's just be honest with ourselves that aid and welfare programs are a way of controlling the poor. But if the reason for the aid programs is justice and what is due the poor for their lives, then I don't think that argument works. Then it's just...
Well, I'm wondering, though, if one is assuming that the poor are not in a position to contribute as much as someone who is better off, then one also has to ask, what are the reasons for not being in a position to contribute? I mean, is this an intrinsic reason of some sort?
I'm not denying that the poor are in a position to contribute. What I'm saying is...
No, I know that, but what I'm saying is that the reason that they may not be able to is because not something intrinsically necessarily, but because the opportunity is not there for them to do such.
Okay,
so they are a potential resource, in other words, not simply a detriment.
Regardless of that, isn't the most basic reason for providing aid to the poor a matter of intrinsic justice, not that without the aid they won't make as great a contribution to the rest of us? I would think the most fundamental intuition behind our reasons for having welfare programs is the notion of rights, that people deserve something of a decent minimal level with which they can maintain dignity relative to others in the society. And it has nothing to do with their contribution.
Well, I agree there.
That's why a certain amount of welfare, the basic minimum, you are eligible for even if you don't work. Though you might tie any increments later to some kind of work.
Is it that you don't work or that you can't work? I'm
No.
not sure I agree with you that you are entitled to something because you don't work.
I would say that justice demands that society provide people with something on the basis of which to exist, even if you can't work. Certainly if you can't work. That would be an example of where we fund things even when people don't make a contribution, but even if you don't work.
I would have to think about that.
Okay. That makes us sort some things out. And if in fact we make a certain decision there, then we might say the reason for our aid programs does have a lot more to do with enabling the poor to make contributions to the society. We even tie certain restrictions on it with that in mind. And then you could say that the reason for having in-kind aid is to enable the poor people to make a greater contribution to society. Now, my question to that would still be, is a poor person able to make a better contribution to society with a Medicaid program that pays for elaborate hospital care and shortchanges housing and, I think, food and other things Or can they make a better contribution by freely choosing what are the most important needs?
Yes. I think you give the care because out of sense of responsibility. But I think that responsibility goes both ways, and therefore it's impossible not to be, in a way, have rules and be parental, because you're also responsible to the people that you take the money from. I mean, if you spend somebody's money and you give it to somebody else, you also have to answer to the person that you are taking the money from. And therefore, I don't think you can, for instance, give cash without any...
We're trying to get, we're already into the business of trying to find non-good, non-parentalistic arguments for in-kind aid. They would be better. Let me just go back and say why I think they're better. In the rest of health law, for example, we have generally disavowed paternalistic, parentalistic conclusions. The most striking example, and I don't think it rests all that much on the religious convictions involved, though that's a dispute in reading the court opinions, is the fact that we would allow an adult, not a minor, but an adult Jehovah's Witness to refuse a blood transfusion even though they're going to die, very clearly because of that refusal. Now clearly, it seems that that's not for their own good. Or at least from our vantage point, it's not for their own good. And only from their own vantage point is it for their own good. So that if you're going to provide aid to the poor and tie it to health care, you have to ask, well, we do that for the poor's own good, the tying of it to health care. But is that for the poor's own good as judged by us or as judged by them? Unless it's as judged by them, it's not parallel to the Jehovah's Witness blood transfusion refusal case. And then to be consistent, it would seem, and treat the poor welfare recipient with as much as having as much autonomy and I think dignity as the Jehovah's Witness, we should give them the freedom to make certain choices. Now, there are more complications because insurance comes ahead of time and the Jehovah's Witness is right in and the crisis at the time making the decision, the poor person might not be. So we've got a lot of other considerations to go through. But initially, I would rather steer clear of paternalistic arguments. So that's why I want to get into non-parentalistic arguments. And we've already talked about one of them. Now we get to another one. Namely, isn't there an obligation to the people who provide the aid, or isn't there some relationship there that requires us to tie the healthcare to the aid to healthcare rather than giving it in the form of income maintenance?
Yeah. If we do the cash basis, then there would have to be a willingness to allow people to make the choice and allow them to make the choice to die. And we would have to be willing to say, no, we will not provide an auxiliary Medicare program for those who don't use the cash in the way that we choose them to use it.
Because,
and then there's other ramifications. Now the adult, what happens in the court program if the minor Jehovah's Witness says, I don't want the blood transfusion, and the father says, I don't want the blood transfusion, they make him a ward of the court and they give him the blood, whether he wants it or not.
If it's a minor. But not if it's an adult.
If it's an adult, that's another story. So it looks like we have to have tiers of...
Okay, that leads to one very quick objection to cash or income maintenance here, which is, what about the children? We would certainly not let the welfare recipient choose to go without health insurance, and as a consequence, not be able to provide even minimal health care for a child that ends up in a crisis. The outcome of that, it's a completely salient argument. Obviously, even in the current realities, consequences, it has to be taken seriously. And I think the outcome of it is that you could never just provide income maintenance without providing at least in-kind maternal child care. But the odd thing is, by and large, we've got separate maternal child care programs already. So you could have separate maternal child care programs, maternal and child care programs, without going to an in-kind provision of health care aid in general. You could have income maintenance plus maternal child care program. It'd be perfectly feasible. Well, there'd be some problems, but I think we're already doing some of that. Anyhow, so it would be possible to do it. You have prenatal and well-child clinics. And you cover emergencies for people up to 21. What you do.
They have government insurance now, don't they? There is government insurance now, isn't that Medicaid and all that sort of thing?
It's not that we have a separate insurance program for maternal and child care. Mm-hmm. It's that we have things like clinics, which are separate. You see, there the government's gone back to this, direct government provision.
And that's what we have.
But by and large, only for maternal and child care.
That's what we have now.
Right. Then you've got government insurance for all the other types of care.
Okay,
and the question is, shouldn't you move this guy? Keep this government provision for maternal and child care, but move this down into CAC.
I see.
You could do so without eroding this for mothers and prospective mothers and children.
They don't want to change the whole system then, as such.
The
whole aid system. They may want to change some of it.
Right.
Is that it?
Right. Yes?
It seems like that doesn't answer some problems, but in any case, it's still semi-parentalistic. It may not be totally parentalistic.
You're taking over the parenting from
the
poor parents. Sure. But it's not really parentalistic because it's not paternalist. That's why maybe the word parentalism is not correct. Maybe we've got to go back to paternalism. You're not restricting the poor parent's choices by saying that the aid, it has to be taken in the form of health care for prospective mothers and children for the sake of the parents. You're doing it for the sake of the children, which is a third party.
But that is a parental decision that you're making.
Right. You're right. Parentalism runs us into problems as a term. Gee, I wish it didn't. Paternalism is the term we use to connote restricting a person's choice for their own good, not for somebody else's like the child, but for their own good. And here you would be used in keeping maternal child care. Right. You would say you would not be restricting poor welfare recipients' choices for their own good. You'd be restricting it for the good of the child.
It would get real tricky in the case of the pregnant mother.
The motivation there would have to be for the welfare of the child, that you would restrict the choice. The care, of course, benefits both, but the reason you restrict the choice is for the benefit of the child.
It's an option.
John?
I really don't think that the arguments that you're sitting in, if you are a legislator and you're discussing these kinds of matters, I don't think that the arguments in favor of the voucher system or a social security system as such are parentalistic at all. I think that a legislator, if he's should be considering the good of society, and I think I don't think it comes back so much to focusing on the individual. I think it's the social good, and that might be, so you're really not focusing now, how do we be nice to poor people or anything else? You're talking about what is really best for society.
Okay, I do not want to focus on the good of society as distinct from either the rights or the good of the poor when we as a nation are discussing what welfare programs to have and how big they should be. The reason I don't want to is I don't want to ground that discussion in what good it does all the other people, the non-poor people in the society. And I'd have to elaborate in order to make that clear, a long argument for why there are welfare rights and that the basis of having welfare programs to begin with is the rights of the recipients, not the benefits to the rest of the society. I'm very wary about grounding welfare programs in the benefits to the rest of the society, because if the rest of the society says, well, we're going to get better, greater benefits if we keep the money. You see, I don't want to even give them that option. Philosophically, I don't want to give them that option. That's why I want to steer clear of that. I don't know, maybe that can't be done. Maybe you can't marshal a good argument, a rights argument for welfare, rather than a social contribution.
I think you're talking about individual rights, and I think they're very, very difficult to
To be sure.
There's a point where those two issues merge, isn't there? Because if you think of the rights of the individual, no matter what his standing in society, to give that person a chance to optimize their potential, then that's still individual right, but it also is for the good of the whole society.
It could be both, but the reason you would tie the aid to healthcare, restrict it, should not be for the benefit of the society. It could be for the benefit of another individual, like the child. That's why when you get to child care, I think the arguments for cash go down the tube. But
now, were the arguments for cash, were they mainly so people would have the choice to get the service they choose to get that might not be covered if it was under a plan? In other words, if they wanted to go to a faith healer, if they wanted to go to a chiropractor, if they wanted to go to a masseur or a naturopath who might not otherwise be approved by a plan.
The first thing that's going to happen if you had cash for all but maternal child care, maternal and child. Maternal child is hyphenated, so it's maternal and child care. The first thing that would happen is you'd have people going to shaping their own health plans, and in some cases saying, I'd rather sign up with a faith healer and spend no money on traditional American medical system. The first thing then we're going to see, we're really going to see red when we imagine that, we're going to see a whole lot of charlatans ripping off the poor with fake healthcare programs. To be sure, that is a short-run danger. And maybe, and this would be a good argument, or in kind rather than cash, aid. Maybe it's even a long-run danger, which cannot be overcome in any way. It's endemic in our whole economic system. But the question I at least want to raise is, aren't we being somewhat condescending toward the poor in thinking that even in the long run they would not sort things out? The short run, admittedly, is very bothersome. But in the long run, isn't the worst thing a society can do to the poor to take away the responsibility of them to make their own decisions? That's what may keep them poor. Unless we're going to just become a society which doesn't require people to make a lot of decisions in order to succeed, then you wouldn't need the poor. The poor wouldn't need to take responsibility in order to become part of the mainstream. But isn't it in a society where taking responsibility, so to speak, is necessary to getting into the mainstream, isn't it very regrettable indeed that the society shapes has programs which discourage people from taking their own responsibility? Now, to be sure, you're weighing long run versus short advantages versus short run disadvantages in making the cash versus in-kind decision at that point. But I at least want to raise that question and wonder whether, as a goal, we shouldn't work toward increasing freedom, toward a cash arrangement, so that when we talk about a particular in-kind policy now, we have to ask ourselves, how is this a temporary measure for the next 20, 30 years, and how are we moving toward increasing responsibilities in that? But maybe all that is just terribly utopian. First thing I want to get clear on is the theoretical and moral arguments on this, and then I want to temper those arguments with the practical considerations, rather than just starting out with all kinds of practical considerations and never seeing clearly what the principled issues are.
In this case, you would then not provide a backup system. You would, I mean, the person would be responsible for their own health and say they spend the money on, say, on a crack. There would be no backup system by the government to pick them up at the last moment and save their life. You're totally responsible. This is the money, and you handle it any way you want to. But if you make the wrong decision, you die.
What we could do, there's a hybrid here. What we could do is say, that is just too painful an experience for any society to endure. Watching poor people die because they didn't insure or they went to a quack. So what we will have to do to satisfy our own emotions is provide crisis care for even those people. And then you're creating a free riding situation in which, of course, the poor wouldn't choose to spend so that they could ride on the other program when the crisis came up. What I think you might do is carve out for government provision or insurance the maternal child area on the one end, and on the other area, and the real crisis care. Now, the problem there is drawing a line. And in the middle, amidst them, for a lot of other care, you just wouldn't have government insurance or provision. At that point, the practical problems get so insuperable, we're probably going to end up going back to in-kind aid. There was a question over here. I turned this way, and I want to make sure I don't.
What's the matter with the present Medicaid system? What are your arguments against that?
Well, first of all, it ties people to a system of traditional American medicine, which is very expensive, at the same time that it doesn't cover all of it.
What doesn't it cover?
Well, it covers only portions of hospitals.
I suppose different states are in the area.
It depends
on the state.
I don't know what all the different states are, but in many states it doesn't cover anything like all of it.
I'm talking about Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Which is all ages.
But in some states, at least, Medicaid is very similar to Medicare and still requires users of it to pay 20% of cost. Now, 20% of a contemporary hospital bill is devastating.
But it's based on income, isn't it? The participation is based on income.
But even for the very poor, there are still co-payment provisions in some states.
And for people that get Medicare and cannot pay the difference, Medicaid picks it up.
And if it pays, they're real horns of this dilemma. That's the horn on the one end if you don't cover everything. If you cover everything, then poor people stand back after a while and say, my gosh, look at the total amount of money that's being spent on Medicaid, which the society's getting itchy about too. What's the total amount of money spent on Medicaid when here I am with very inadequate shelter and food, say, or other things too.
And of course, people abuse it as they do.
Right. So it certainly let's be very clear at the beginning of the discussion. Providers love this. The healthcare providers don't want cash. They don't want to have anything to do with that, because then people don't have to use the resources on them. If in fact all this is tied in with the previous part of the previous discussion, namely that by structuring the medical economy the way we have, without much competition but with a lot of insurance, we have given providers a blank check to shape the system the way they want without regard to costs.
I disagree with that. Providers, certainly, if you have government insurance, if a provider provides a service and is reimbursed, but not at what he wants to get, but rather at what that government insurance thinks it is worth. And if he wants to get it back, he gets to provide, or they get to provide it, under the myriad of rules and regulations that the government sets up that they get it back at. So I've heard you a couple of times say, they love it. And sure, they get their money, but it isn't like they get it on a silver platter. They get to go through a lot of hassles to get it.
Okay, the question is, how does the government set the reimbursement?
By the going rate, that area.
It sets it by a certain percentage of the going rate. It is the providers who establish the going rate.
Yes, but and it's more complicated than you make it sound.
I'm not saying providers love government reimbursement. No. Oh, no, they don't like government reimbursement. But if there's going to be government aid, they'd rather have it in kind, tied to health care. The one just political observation is, look at the AMA's tune on Medicare. The AMA knows very well, if you look at what Medicare has done in the healthcare market, some observers surmise, there's dispute about this, that it is the single biggest factor in the very large increase in doctors' incomes in the late 60s. Medicare. Now, would they rather put up with the put up with the regulation in order to get a lot more resources of society poured into them?
But you know,
bet they will. And the AMA, that's why the AMA has changed its tune.
But when a hospital bed is paid for at a Medicare rate, there is a certain portion that nonprofit hospitals have to write off. And I am not an economist,
That's right.
I would argue that
Right. Nothing
gets written off.
That's right.
It all gets paid for, and you pay for it, and I pay for it, because when we go to the hospital, our bill is not discounted 20%. We pick that up. And into our 20% is the 20% of the bed next to us that's a Medicare bed. And it's much more complicated than that, but I know nothing gets written off financially in this world.
That's right. There's no free lunch about anything.
It comes out of the private sector.
That's right.
One way or another.
That's right. So the government isn't paying anything. It's just that...
It just gets passed on to you and I.
Sure. Providers would rather have middle-class patients who have private insurance plans because they put even fewer restrictions on what the providers can get. But...
It's de facto taxation, really.
Yes.
Taxation, sure. I mean, if you pay more for medical care, instead of paying to the government, you're paying to the hospital. But it's still supporting the social system.
Okay. Now, let me be very clear in this. I'm not saying that hospitals are ripping people off. I'm saying they've been given a blank check so they don't have to consider, and patients don't have to consider, whether the money that's spent on our whole healthcare system at the margins is a good buy. Certainly the basic part of it is a good part, but it's the margins. That is not a question which our present policies force either patients or the government or insurers to consider very much. The government tries to. It's the one who wants to consider it the most, but the government basically has to follow the lead of others, or it'll get too much flack from the providers, and just that'll build up flack. Morale problems and inefficiencies, and the government doesn't want to get into it. That, by the way, is the reason why Enthoven and the supporters of competition want to wipe out Medicare, wipe out Medicaid, get rid of all government insurance with all the regulations that it involves, and give people a voucher, and then structure other laws so that, like permitting doctor advertising, etc., so that you get as much competition as possible. That would be better than all the regulations. And in fact, it's going to be interesting to see which way the AMA goes on that. Ideologically, they've been warring against regulation, but I'm not so sure they're going to be all that strongly supportive of competition. They may take regulation over competition in the bargain. Let me just mention a couple of other things, because we've only got 5 minutes. We don't necessarily have to reserve room for discussion, because that's nicely been integrated, all of this. The responsibility to consider the source of the aid, namely the other people in the society, was raised. The argument has been made that it is in the interest of the poor to take the aid in the form of restricted health care rather than as income maintenance, because if you take it as income maintenance, politically you just won't get society to fund it at a very high level. Whereas if you take it in restricted aid, people will say, oh, it's not being abused for alcohol or whatever. And they'll be willing to fund the programs at a higher level. Now, that is a perfectly good argument if you assume that that is what society's political preferences are. then, to be sure, it's the right of the poor to say, we're welfare and money ahead by taking the restricted in-kind program instead of insisting on the freedom that cash and income maintenance involve. But let me note that though that's a very legitimate response for the poor to make, and therefore a good argument for them for taking in-kind programs now, and even perhaps bargaining for them rather than bargaining for income maintenance, the question it raises is, why should society be willing to fund in-kind programs at a higher level than income maintenance? If we were concerned about justice in society, distributive justice of income, wouldn't society be as willing to be willing to fund cash programs at as high a level as restricted programs? I mean, what does it say about a society when it is willing to fund in-kind programs at a higher level than income maintenance programs? I think it says that society again has its focus on what it thinks is the proper behavior of the poor, or on the contributions the poor might make to society, or those things, rather than on the inherent justice of people having not such unequal income levels to work with in their lives. That's what it says. So it seems to me it forces us to ask questions about ourselves as a society, and I can find no justification, finally, for society, as part of society, being willing to fund an in-kind aid program at a higher level than a cash program.
See, we want our justice for the poor.
That's one way of putting it. Now, to be sure, that may be overstated, but I at least want to raise the issue by putting it that strong.
I don't know why you can't separate those two things. If you, on the one hand, decide that, you would get better funding if you do in-kind program here. The other issue is there are all kinds of other needs for the poor that ought to be handled in a different way. We're simply looking at healthcare as one item that has a certain preference here, or giving a certain priority. That doesn't necessarily take away from increasing the level of some other needs, or provision for other needs.
No, but the problem with being willing to provide all the other needs at a well-funded level too, is that unless you give it in the form of cash, I don't really see that the poor are going to get the right input into the decision-making process about how much should go for food, how much should go for rent subsidy, how much should go for health care, etc.
I'm not arguing against that. You might have in-kind
For all the rest. No, I'm arguing, what we need to pick up is this argument, too. We're obviously not running out. We picked up these two, and to some extent this one, though, there's a different version of it. We're not going to get to that one. The necessity, though. The argument is that medical care is a necessity, other things are not a necessity.
For one thing, it's the realization of the high cost of health care, too. That would prompt people to say, okay, we're willing to provide more there. And the other thing is, if they would like to have better housing, maybe that could be a motivation for them to work towards that. But when the necessity arises for medical care, that may be beyond their ability to help at that time. So that's more an emergency.
What I would like to see, if we do have in-kind programs, this is as utopian, however, as anybody could charge an income maintenance program to be. What I would like to see if you have in-kind programs is such sensitivity to the competing needs of the poor and to their own, although not individually, but group, preferences about how important different needs are, that we would actually shape design. It might have to be by government provision, because there might be nobody in the private sector that would offer it. A program for the poor, which I would call low style. It would be distinctly less expensive. Of course, there are practical objections. That's why I called it utopian. It might not have anything like the regular American hospital in it. After all, Morocco doesn't have the regular American hospital, and that's smart on their part. So why would you? So maybe you'd have a hospital for the poor in our country, but you might not have one like American hospital. I mean, I look at Georgetown Hospital, where I was last year, and I just cannot conclude that that's the best way to deliver health care to the poor. And yet, our whole health care system, when you run into a crisis, puts the poor person in a hospital. And they're going to say, just like in the Novocaine case, darn it all, I'd rather be in something that costs only $100 a day instead of $260 a day and have $160 a day to spend on something else, even if I run a higher chance of dying in the process. That gets back to the price of life discussion and the contention that a poor person's pricing of their own life just is lower. And we ought to respect that. It's part of their autonomy. There's nothing insulting about acknowledging those differences at all, as long as we don't misuse them in policy. Now, I haven't gotten to the misuses of this claim that the pricing of life is actually lower for the rich. One question, and then we'll adjourn.
Is it true, Paul, that people on a lower economic level, if equally insured, equally well insured, you just use the facility significantly less?
Yes. No. They use it more if it's the only thing they're getting free. And that's why you get charges about the abuse of the healthcare system. But that's understandable since it may be the only thing they're getting, one of the few things they're getting.